Word on Health with Paul Pennington.
For your very best of health.
The slogan for this year's World Health Organization's World Patient Safety Day is Elevate the Voice of Patients to ensure they're involved in policy formulation, are represented in governance structures, engaged in designing safety strategies, and are active partners in their own care. Something our very own Patients Association has spent over 60 years campaigning for. Joining me to discuss this is their CEO, Rachel Power. Rachel, where are we at in the UK in providing platforms and opportunities for patients, families and communities to raise their voice, concerns and expectations and preference to advance patient-centeredness, trustworthiness and equity?
From the Patient Association's viewpoint, there has been progress. We do have a lot of lived experience. We do have a Department of Health listening to patients. But you'll have seen in a lot of the news recently that those same issues around lack of communication, around lack of information, exist within the system at the moment. We get to see some really good pockets of engagement and where people really want to listen to patients and understand what they need.
What more do you feel needs to be done?
Our strategy is patient partnership in the design and delivery of services. And actually, we wouldn't have that strategy if we thought that patients were engaged routinely throughout all health and care, both in individual consultations and shared decision making, but also in patient partnership in the design and delivery of services. There's been numerous different documents coming out, including the NHS Constitution, that talks about patient-centered care. We are just about to launch our own principles of patient partnership. And in there, we have six key principles. One is treating patients as equals. Two is that patients are fully informed. Three is that shared decision making and patient partnership happen routinely throughout the system. Four is that we recognize inequalities and we understand how to support people to be able to have that power in the relationship that they may want to have. And that five is that it's around seeking patient information at all times, but seeking patient information before you design a service, trying to work out what that service will mean to patients. And six is joining services around patients. That would bring me back to the patient-centered care as well, because we hear too often from patients that they don't know where to go. They don't know where to get the next piece of advice because there's so many people involved in their care.
And do you think these principles can be achieved without having to invest huge amounts of money from the public purse?
Absolutely. And in developing these principles, we started with patients and we asked patients what they felt needed to be in place. And we ran quite a number of focus groups to do that. And then we tested them with system leaders. And if you look at these principles and you look at all the information that's out there, if you look at the NHS Constitution, if you look at Hewitt Review, if you look at the role of integrated care boards, all of this is in these documents. But what we've tried to do is simplify it down. And I think that we have the evidence. If you run with these principles, they will make sure that services work better for patients. They'll be more motivational for healthcare staff because they're working for patients, and they'll be more cost effective and they will be safer services. So I don't think there's a huge amount of money to be spent to do them. I think they just simplify what's already there into something that's much more accessible across the board.
My grateful thanks to Rachel Power. To find out more and to connect through to the Patients Association, log onto our website, www.wordandhealth.com. That's www.wordandhealth.com.
Keeping you in touch with the health and lifestyle issues that matter. This is Word on Health with Paul Pennington.
There are 41,000 women living with ovarian cancer in the UK, with over 7,000 new cases diagnosed each year. If caught at an early stage, 9 in 10 women will survive. But two-thirds of women are diagnosed late, when the cancer is harder to treat. Knowing the symptoms of ovarian cancer could save your life or the life of someone you love. Catherine Murray is from Target Ovarian Cancer.
Key symptoms of ovarian cancer are a persistent bloated tummy, always feeling full or not being able to finish a meal, tummy pain, and then urinary symptoms needing to wee more often or more urgently. These symptoms will be new for you and they'll be frequent. So we usually say as a guide they'll be happening around 12 times a month or more frequently in the last 3 weeks.
I understand occasionally there can be other symptoms such as changes in bowel habit, i.e. diarrhea or constipation, extreme fatigue, unplanned weight loss, and unusual bleeding from the vagina, which before or after the menopause should always be investigated by a GP. And talking of GPs, I see from your research, nearly half mistakenly believe symptoms only present in the later stages of ovarian cancer, something I know your organisation are looking to change.
It's really important for GPs to know the symptoms and to be skilled up on ovarian cancer. We offer GP education modules on the symptoms and also on things like family history and why that's important in ovarian cancer.
You spoke earlier about the frequency of symptoms. What can women do that might help their doctors?
Write them down. Make a diary if you have one, or just take some notes about the frequency of these symptoms. It can really help to have it all in front of you when you go into that GP appointment.
Ovarian cancer is more prevalent in the over 50s, but 1 in 10 cases occur in women below the age of 45. I believe 40% of women wrongly think a cervical smear test detects it.
The cervical smear test does not pick up ovarian cancer. It only looks for changes in the cells of the cervix, which could then lead to cervical cancer.
Sadly, we do lose 11 women in the UK every day to ovarian cancer, but I understand new treatments do provide promise for those living with it.
What we've seen in the last 10-15 years is lots of progress in new treatments and new types of treatments, and we've seen that's given a lot of hope to our community. We still need to get this early diagnosis. You still have the best outcomes in ovarian cancer if you get diagnosed earlier. So that's why it's important to always know the symptoms, get to the GP, and that way your GP can get you into treatment if you need it.
My grateful thanks to Catherine Murray. To find out more and to link through to Target Ovarian Cancer, visit our website, www.wordonhealth.com. That's www.wordonhealth.com.
Word on Health, for your very best of health.
With the flu season and the emergence of variants of the coronavirus creating new challenges, it's our collective responsibility to remain proactive and health conscious at a time when the chances of viral transmission naturally increase. Those who are invited for vaccination of both flu and COVID jabs should take up the offer. For those of us outside the at-risk groups, we must prioritise our well-being through ensuring our immunity system is in tip-top condition. Dr. Jill Jenkins is a GP and medical journalist.
There are several ways in which you can boost your immune levels. The bottom line for a lot of people is simply what the old-fashioned folk might call healthy living. Not having a huge alcohol intake, not smoking, not being overweight, so trying to lose a little bit of weight if you're overweight. Activity actually helps your immune levels too, so being active, bit of exercise. I'm not saying join a gym or go mad on tennis, just walking a bit more, bit of cycling, swimming, simple stuff. That will help. Then you can consider your diet, and if you have a healthy, balanced diet, and by that we mean one that follows, if you have a computer, you can look for the Eat Well plate that the government shows, and it follows a mix of vegetables, different colours, as they say, a rainbow of vegetables, fruit, dairy and meat or fish, and pulses. So a good balance of those will help. The other area that you may help yourself is by taking a multivitamin and mineral supplement. We know that several of the vitamins and minerals in our diet may be deficient. The National Dietary Survey tells us that. And secondly, are related to your immune health. So there you have the building blocks for trying to help your immune system.
For those that pick up a COVID or flu infection, they should follow government advice on staying at home and cut down contact with others until they're well. The amount of respiratory virus can build up in poorly ventilated areas. Bringing fresh air into a room, even for a few minutes, helps remove stale air that could contain virus particles. A further proven way to stop the spread of all winter ailments and COVID-19 is in our own hands. Coughs and sneezes spread diseases, so covering our mouths when we do so is essential. And ensuring we regularly wash our hands properly is also key, as Professor Sally Bloomfield from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine explains.
There's a whole host of reasons which, when you put them together, shows that there is a real need to improve standards of hygiene. We could produce up to 50% reduction in gastrointestinal infections by hand washing and 24% of respiratory infections. So it's about washing our hands when we know we might have germs on our hands, after going to the toilet, after handling raw food, after looking after our pets, after touching multiple surfaces, washing them properly, rubbing them well, all over your hands, rubbing between your fingers with soap. The recommended time is 15 to 20 seconds. I'm told that if you sing happy birthday twice, that's about 15 seconds. And then rinse your hands thoroughly under the tap and dry. Now, there are situations when you can't do that. And at that point in time, the alcohol gels are very useful to make sure that your hands are hygienic.
My grateful thanks to Dr. Jill Jenkins and Professor Sally Bloomfield. For further information, visit our website, www.wordandhealth.com. That's www.wordandhealth.com.
Keeping you in touch with the health and lifestyle issues that matter. This is Word on Health with Paul Pennington.
1 in 7 adults, or 10 million people across the UK, is thought to be affected by migraine. And more than 1 million have chronic migraine, which means they experience symptoms for at least 15 days of the month. This year, revolutionary new treatments have become available that promise to transform the lives of people living with migraine. But, it's claimed, many patients find it almost impossible to access these new treatments. Dr. Katie Munro, author of the book Manage Your Migraine and a clinician at the National Migraine Centre, explains why.
One of the main reasons is that patients have to be eligible. So they have to have tried at least 3 preventative medications that are usually taken orally before they're eligible. There's a huge shortage of headache specialists. And then even when they do get through the long waiting list, and they are sometimes told, well, actually, in this particular area, we haven't been able to prescribe these things because either the systems are not set up, we don't have the infrastructure of staffing, or the budget's not allocated. We hear different stories from different parts of the country, and these patients are desperate for help. And obviously, the NHS is under huge pressure, not least with the pressures of COVID. The waiting lists were already long. With more information about these new medications, the demand has gone up. So more people are asking to be referred.
The chairman of the British Association for the Study of Headache has called for a nationally agreed educational framework and quality standard for primary care, as we have with other important long-term conditions. How might this help?
I think anything that sets some standards that increases awareness, that provides a very good educational process to upskill doctors, then the better for people who do suffer from this debilitating condition, of which I'm one. I mean, I'm speaking from the heart here because it took me quite a lot of time as a working GP to even identify my own migraine, to get appropriate help for it, and to work out a way forward.
When it comes to raising awareness, one of the common public misconceptions is that migraines are just a bad headache.
A migraine is a disorder. One of the many symptoms of migraine attacks is headache, but they also bring dizziness, nausea, vomiting, sometimes visual disturbances, tingling, paresthesia down the arm, that kind of thing. Sometimes tummy pain in children. Not everybody does get headaches. Some lucky people say, I've never had a headache.
Where are we at in our understanding of what causes migraine and who's at risk?
Well, potentially, anybody who has a family history of migraine is at risk, because we know that part of the picture is a genetic inheritance. And I often say to people, you know, it's your ancestors, but also think about your descendants, because we know if one or two parents have migraine, then it's much more likely that their children will. The genes for migraine set the brain to be always rather more sensitive to change. The brain doesn't deal with it terribly well. There's a sensory sensitivity. So light, sound, movement, even touch sometimes, and certainly smells, can irritate the brain of somebody with migraine. Also changes in things in the external environment, for example, flickering lights, or maybe weather changes, thundery weather. So we know that there are epigenetic factors as well that activate the genes. Once that's happened, then neurochemicals or proteins are released in the brain, and they cause a change in the cell surfaces that runs over the surface of the brain, causing electrical differences. And that's where we get the symptoms that seem to sort of progress from one part of the head to the other and cause different symptoms in various parts of the body. We know the names of some of these neurochemicals, and we know one in particular specifically is very much implicated in some people's migraine attack. And that's the one which has been targeted by these revolutionary new treatments. But there are others, and there is some study going on looking at whether some of these other things might lead to medications that will help.
My grateful thanks to Dr. Katie Munro. To find out more, visit our website, www.wordonhealth.com. That's www.wordonhealth.com.
Word on Health, on air and online 52 weeks of the year with Paul Pennington. Word on Health, your personal prescription for your very best of health.